David Bohm Seminar Series 1, November 7th, 1987, 5:15 afternoon session, Oak Grove School, Ojai, California.
Right. Yes, well, we've been discussing anger, and this gentleman here is worried, made an objection that he thinks that pleasure would be a more fundamental question. It may well be so, but I think anger is an easier one to get into, and it will begin to show the structure. Pleasure, to see through the corresponding thing and pleasure is going to be more subtle than anger, because anyway, we all admit that anger is something that's unpleasant and bad, and we want to do something about it, but pleasure, you know, we don't really want to do anything about it, right? Well, we're on the question of saying, see, the point is to say that this whole thing is a display or an indicator of a fault, right? That it has very little value in itself. In some sense, this whole pattern of feelings and movements is reflecting the source, right? That's what I'm saying, their source. But this may be very subtle, you see. It may be beyond what we ordinarily know by thinking. You see, if the technician is going to fix the repair the set which has a fault, then he needs something beyond the thought process. You see, let's say in this case it's as elementary as, say, a screwdriver. But we can't really take a simple thing like a screwdriver to the mind, or even a thing like a drug, you see, which is sort of something comparable to saying there's a fault in the system, let's try to put something in there that'll correct it. A drug or some other process. And I think that's too mechanical. You see, this whole thing is so subtle. A drug may correct one bit of it, but then other bits are not corrected, or it may even make them worse. Right? It has side effects, and it doesn't get at this whole the whole mistake, because, for example, the observer and the observed and all that. It doesn't get at this structure, which is faulty, not the whole of it, or not the essential features of it. But still, there are several things that may happen, you see. We were discussing this morning, for example, biofeedback, where somebody said a wire may be connected to a single nerve in the finger and to a loudspeaker, so that when the nerve fires, the loudspeaker clicks. Now then, a person learns somehow to make it click by doing something that cannot be described. And then he learns to do better and to control it, you see, to make it play a tune even. And it cannot be described how this happens, but you see, you can sort of guess that as long as there is some process which tells him when he's getting closer or further away, that he makes some sort of move which you cannot describe, and if it comes closer, then that means the system makes a similar move the next time. If it goes further away, then it doesn't, right? It's sort of groping and feeling out and finding a way to reach that nerve, right? So the system is able to reach a single nerve by learning this, right? And there's some process that goes on which is beyond what we ordinarily mean by thought, right? There's nothing especially mysterious about it or anything, but it, you know, everybody knows it. Now, you see, so let's say that if we regard anger or fear or whatever as the display of the fault, then being guided by that display, the system moves in such a way as to correct it. You see, now that fault might be as much physical and chemical as it is mental, right? Because, you know, if you have a pattern of thought and feeling, some nerves may have been firing that way for a long time, producing fixed synapse connections and neurochemicals, so that it's very, very easy to go in that pattern and rather hard to go in another one. And is that clear, that you form a habit in that way? And you could ask, it may not be possible to touch those nerves, or those synapses, and begin to change them, to discharge the chemicals, to make them work differently, so that it gets released, right, from that pattern. We don't say it will or it won't, but it's a thing that doesn't seem impossible, right? That if your intention is to really keep your attention on there, then perhaps that can happen. But of course, attention jumps off, right? I mean, you may have noticed that.
If it was sustained attention, it would come back. It would be like anything else. You would work on it for a little while when it was right, and then go do it. But it would be a sustained form of action.
Mm. Yes, if the attention jumps off into something else, then this isn't going to stop, you see. But anyway, and then we could say, well, we have then got to give our attention to why it jumps off. That is a display of another fault, right?
Well, I think one can never really be sure that they've all completely dissipated.
No, just simply, why does it happen? You see, suppose I say I'm going to suspend anger and pay attention to what's happening, and I find myself wandering into some other thought, right? And I say, and one view is to say, well, I can't do it. It's too much for me, you see, and then that'll stop it, right? That thought stops it. But suppose I say it's important to go on, then I ask a question, why is it that it moves off, right? And then I say, that is also the result of the fault, right? I'm saying, I think, see, Krishnamurti used to have a nice phrase that there is no distraction. See, every distraction, what we call distraction, is a sign of something significant, right? That's going, not working right.
There's only a distraction if you think you have some direction you want to go.
Well, it's only if you think it's a distraction, then it's a distraction, you see. So if you think that you've got to get a certain result, as you say, then you think this is a distraction. By thinking it's a distraction, then that's what it is, right?
And you automatically set up that resistance.
Yeah. You say, this is bad to get distracted, and therefore I must resist this distraction. But it's the same as resisting anger and resisting self-deception and so on, right? Because on the one hand, you want to be distracted, right? On the other hand, you say, I must not be distracted, right?
But if a person doesn't set up any parameters to say this is where I have to act within, then how could they be distracted from it? I mean, life is sort of a...
Yeah, but we do set up parameters. See, the point is the mind
the
is...
Problem.
Yeah, the mind is set up to set up parameters. That's the fault, right?
Right.
That's part of the fault, right?
Right.
The fault is not merely intellectual. It is also not only emotional, it is also neurophysiological and chemical, right?
And that's what you'd call a habit or a...
Yeah, it's the whole system.
Does everything become a paradox?
What?
Does everything become a paradox?
Well, it's not exactly a paradox. It's just that it's a contradiction, you see. That the whole process is constantly going into self-contradiction, right? Which makes conflict. You know, saying, I want to do this, but I must do something else, right? Now, you see, so that's the whole result of society, which has the notion of control. It says if something is going wrong, we're going to deal with it by trying to control it, right? Push it, make it right, you see. But that may hold for, as I said, external things. But we're applying it in a case where control has no meaning, because the controller is controlled by what he thinks he's going to control, right? That the feeling which you think you're going to control is controlling you, right?
This is actually very important, though, because whenever we work with any of these things we're talking about, it seems that in the end we do feel like we've been successful in controlling. We must feel that or we would not continue to believe. Apparently we're successful in controlling our fear, in controlling our anger. We pretty deeply believe that we in fact do that.
Yes, but then what I'm questioning, I'm saying that I don't think it happens.
Perhaps not, but we continue to believe it. Whether it's happening or not, we very much believe that we can do that.
Yes, and we want to believe it, right? No, that might be disturbing to give up that belief. No, if you don't believe you're in control, it could be very disturbing.
That's the point.
Well,
but if you're not in control, what? Yeah.
Go ahead.
I just want to make one statement. If you're not in control, then you say, I believe I'm in control, then therefore you are deceiving yourself, right? And then you feel better, right?
Well, that's where the pleasure and pain really is clear, isn't it?
Yeah.
The pleasure of thinking you've deceived yourself, but you really know you haven't, and there's the pain.
Well, it's disturbing to think you're not in control, but it's more disturbing if you think nobody's in control.
Well, that's the fact, though, isn't it? Yes, no, that's the fact that nobody is in control. It's only necessary to look at the newspapers to see that nobody's in control.
Well, that's part of the fun of the whole thing, really, because you're not in control. You don't know when something is going to pop up any minute. And it really makes life very interesting.
Particularly for the victim.
Well, for, yeah, any number of people.
Well, we aren't in control, and we could say that there's no way really to control thought. And yet, what will we do with thought if it can't be controlled, you see? See, well, then if it goes wrong, what are we to do? People are worried about that, right? But I think I wanted to focus now on the illusion of control, that there is an illusion of control, just as there's an illusion of the thinker and the thought being separate. So there's an illusion that the thinker is the controller who is separate from what is controlled, right? Now, that notion holds with regard to, say, to machines and our various objects we make, that to some extent we are in control of them, not really completely because they break down and do things we don't expect, but to some extent we control them, right? And then we say we are going to try to control ourselves in a similar way. But it doesn't work, right? It can't work because we are not separate from what we want to control. We are controlled by what we want to control. This, in fact, is happening with our machines, too, that to a large extent they control our lives. We have to serve them in order to get what we want, right? And if we don't, we're in trouble, you see. So also all this information coming, you know, through modern communications, is we're not in control of it. It may be controlling us. There is a kind of illusion of control which is especially powerful in our modern technological society, you know, but it was there in other societies too, right? And it is a very frightening thought to think that, at least to one who has the illusion of control, it is a very frightening thought to think that there's nothing, no control over anything, that it's all running without control. Now, I think we have to go into that. It really is without control, and that it would be more accurate to say it's running wild.
But it isn't funny.
No, it's not funny, but it's funny in a way. It's funny in a way, right? I mean, if you take...
It's funny for Julia.
Yes. That is... It is running wild, you see, and the whole process of thought, I think... We could come to that's one of the, that it runs wild in anger, it runs wild further in aggression and hate, and it runs wild in desire for pleasure and so on. And they're all basically one process. And we have to go into that. You see, why is thought running wild, and why, and we also have the thought that it's all perfectly in order and under control, right, by which we fit. Avoid being disturbed by the fact that it's running wild.
Everybody's able to rationalize their behavior. Even terrorists says, I'm doing this for the good of the cause, and I mean, people in Beirut and all these places where it must be total chaos, I can't understand. They must have some rationale. It just, everybody thinks that what they believe is correct and that the way to do it, I mean, that's what's running, that's how, that's the end result of this kind of a process, is always this chaos of each individual.
Yeah, but the chaos starts in the whole, the thought process itself is in chaos, but it is being covered up by the assumption that it is under control. The same way the television, you know, you see the telephone bell ringing, so you see controlled thought going on. Both the same sort of thing, right?
Dr. Bohm, when in sleep, there are different REMs, is that what it's called?
Rapid eye movements, yeah.
But if one watches them, there's a period when there is no eye movement. Is that the period when thought is quiescent?
Well, it might be. I mean, it's hard to investigate that, but one view is that eye movements are a part of, eye movements are necessary to see things clearly without. Now, if you're imagining things, the eyes also move as if you were looking at them. That's one. Right? If the eyes don't, that's a prop to make the imagination more real, right? You see? If the eyes don't move, then the image loses a large sense of its reality. See, all the physical props connected with the image make it more real. So if you're thinking of something, your eye moves as if you were looking at it. In order to look at it, your eye must move, you see. It must scan it and do all sorts of things. If you stop that, then you prove that vision vanishes, right? It's been proved experimentally.
Where does the thought go then?
What? Well, if there were no eye movement, thought might cease. I don't know, you see. It would seem so unreal that it wouldn't be worth going on with. You see, there are those thoughts which have no value. We've been discussing them, right? And which, in fact, are destructive, right? Which tend to fill our mind.
Research shows that there are a lot of thoughts that go on in deeper than rapid eye movement phase of sleep, but we have amnesia for the process. It's very hard to pick up those memories of what's going on.
Yeah, eye movements may not be the only way to maintain thought, right? But it's one way. But it gives an idea that some kind of movement probably is needed to maintain thought, right? It may be inside or outside or on the surface or in the eye or somewhere, to give it that sense of reality. You see, there's an interesting thing. So they show pictures of random dots, you see, on the television, and you see nothing there. Now, if these dots change in a certain order, they remain random, but they change in a certain order, you see a cat moving, right? See, as long as it's moving, you get the sense of reality of the cat, but when it stops, you see nothing but random dots. I've seen that thing. That merely getting, you get a series of frames where the random dots are all slightly different in the next frame, the next frame, the next frame. And then as they succeed each other, you get a sense of a real cat that's moving.
I was hoping that when it was quiescent, I could take some trips out into space.
Well, maybe, but you see, how would you do it? You see, that would be movement, right? That raises another question, that there is no thought without some kind of physical movement. That seems to be the neurochemical movement, you know, some movement going on. And to a certain extent, these are habitual patterns of movement that may be ingrained, you see, in the structure of the system. Which, I'm saying, if we look at this suspension of activity, then there's a chance for the system to start to smooth that out. Right? This is only a beginning, but it suggests a direction in which something might be done. You see that we have got to give it our attention, and if we gave it such attention that every irrelevant movement of thought would stop, right? Only those thoughts which were meaningful, relevant, orderly, and so on would go on. And therefore, thoughts like anger and fear and hate and so on would stop, right? Because there's no foundation for them, no basis. They are merely a sign of a disorder, you know, of a sign of a fault. And therefore, the fault being corrected, they would stop. That is, they are useless, wasteful, destructive movement, right? the wrong kind. And they probably wear out the brain cells if you carry it out too much and so on.
If you understood the destructive aspects of thought, would that change the physiological momentum that's been built up after years of thinking in this
way?
Well,
it depends on the
level. I attain certain,
I didn't hear that.
Certain times I can attain what I consider quite strong perception, but you always go back to thought. It seems like the physical momentum is still there.
Yes, well, to some extent you have to, you see. I'm trying to say there is that thought which is orderly and rational and useful and necessary and whatnot, but there are the thought that we have in the anger process, right? Or in the, the panic process. Hmm? Now, you see...
There are reactions that are instantaneous, almost instantaneous. You react to a certain situation.
Something actually happening.
Yeah.
Which causes you to react.
Yes, but then, yeah. Then comes the thought, about it, right?
Yes, but what about that reaction? I mean, the way you're talking, it's as though all of these reactions are of negative value.
Well, it's the thought which is connected with them which is of negative value, the fact that they're sustained by thought. You see, if you have a reaction of anger, say a very young child has it, and it doesn't last very long. The dog is only able to maintain anger by being confronted with the dog that it hates, right? Now, but we can maintain an image of which maintains anger by thinking, right? Now, that is a destructive process, I say. By thinking thoughts that are false.
Go ahead, Sarah.
You see something which needs attention, it's wrong.
Yes.
Yeah.
And one reacts. And then you need to think about whatever action is necessary to
That's fine. That's perfectly all right.
I mean, you wouldn't do anything just from thought alone, I feel. You need that move. The prime mover is one's instant reaction to a situation.
Yes, that's fine. Now, the point is that suppose I react by saying, I give an explanation of why I have reacted, which is that somebody has treated me very badly, and so on.
That one sees. I'm talking about, for instance, if I see someone behaving very badly to someone else, I still react.
Yeah, but you see, but let's take the next step. You see, what will you do? You see, it may be that if you just plunge in there, it would get worse, right? So therefore you start to think, you see, but usually if you may think rational thoughts about it, saying what would be the right thing to do and so on, but what often happens is, it's terrible what's happening there. It's outrageous, I must, I have good reason to be angry and to go in there and be aggressive and do something, right? Do you see?
You're saying always that's wrong, that's
a That's a pattern, it seems to me, I don't see how it can be right.
Let's get this into some specific factual situation. I mean, we're just talking about principles, and I'm having difficulty working this into a real life situation that I'm confronting. I personally am confronting. And my 95-year-old mother is in a nursing home. I go in one day, and I find her bruised, and she's been abused.
Yes.
Well, I mean, I'm angry.
Good. You see, now, go ahead. Well, what's the next step? But what is the next step?
Yeah, right. So what is the next step? What is the next step appropriate? I know what the next step was. I mean, it's already history. But whether it was appropriate action is not, I don't know.
Well, what was, you wanted to get factual. What was the next step?
Well, the next step with me was that the anger just grew and grew and grew. But I had to consider what action to take. But obviously the anger arises out of what actually happened and what I think should have been.
Well, no, it may have a perfectly good reason to be angry in the beginning, saying there was this mistreatment and your immediate reaction is very strong. Now, but see, really, if your primary concern is that your mother should not be mistreated, you see.
Yeah.
But if you get angry and begin to become aggressive and so on, she may get worse treatment, you see. You see, that therefore, if your first priority is to get the right treatment for your mother, to begin to thinking, saying this is outrageous what they're doing to my mother, I'm very angry, I must... You know, you start to boil and to go into a chaotic state and so on, and therefore it may get worse. Now, See, you have to be able to maintain a high energy without these false processes.
Yes.
But that has been very hard for people to do throughout the whole of history.
But that implies that the anger is merely inefficient rather than false. The fact is, my mother was abused, and then an hour later, I'm recalling that fact, right?
Yeah.
I'm thinking about it, but I'm thinking about fact. And so the anger arises again, but it doesn't arise in response to something totally fictitious or fantasy. It's the recollection of the fact.
Yes, but then the question is what follows next? You see, the fact doesn't tell you what to do, right?
I'm not sure this is a fact.
What?
Did you witness the abuse?
No. Well, let's assume that it's been established to be a fact, you see, so that it might not be one, but I mean, to limit the discussion, let's assume we've established it to be a fact, right?
Isn't one of the questions, which you value more, what the right action is for your mother or your anger?
Yes, you see, anger may be pleasurable. It gives a sense of release. See, you feel terrible that your mother has been treated that way, or turbulent under tension. You say, I must do something. If I do something, I feel better, right? If I just take an action. Well, no, but I mean, that's what often happens.
Not you in person, but there's a tendency to get angry, to discharge an energy and make you feel like you did something, but the real action may not have happened.
We're really talking about how to deal with the anger of it. That's my real question. To apply what you have presented to us in general principle to a factual situation of allowing anger to flower and then.
Let me try to put it the way I'm trying to say it. That first of all, I say if we start trying to understand it with that tremendously intense problem, it's rather hard. See, I'm suggesting let's look at it in an easier situation first for a little while. And then maybe we'll understand it well enough to do something in that very difficult situation that you describe. It's very important to see the principle of it clearly.
And here in Ojai, we have an ombudsman.
What?
Here in Ojai.
Oh, I understand that.
You have what?
They investigate.
That has nothing to do with my anger, though. I mean, they have one there, too, but that has nothing to do
with I didn't hear what the word was.
Ombudsman.
Oh, yeah.
And they investigate any harm that comes to seniors.
But that doesn't resolve my anger problem.
No. We have this problem that something happens which produces very naturally a very strong reaction. And from there on, what are we going to do? That's the question, you see. In the primitive animal stage, that sort of reaction would have provoked the right action, right? Namely, you're confronted by something that's frustrating you and you might get very angry and, do something, right? But here, it may not, huh? It probably won't. Some new action is called for, some new... It means to suspend that anger and see how it's working and to see whether it is making sense or not. You see, the thing you really need to do is to make the right sensible action, which takes a lot of energy.
The thing is that when you're angry, you seem to have a lot of energy to do things.
Yes, but it may be around.
When you look at it and suspend it, it seems to take away the energy and you don't know what to do because you'll only do something when you have this.
Well, then we've got a problem, which is we can only get energy by false means, and it's no use. You see that by whipping yourself up, you get energy, but then you've got a lot of mud on your spectacles, and you don't know what you're doing, right? So we say, let's not accept that. We're not faced immediately with your problem, right? So we have some leisure now to look at it, the principle, you see. And we say, we can't accept that, you see, saying if that's the way we do, then it's not worth it. You say anyway, we'll probably be finished in the long run. So I say we must see if we can find another way. And how? You see, we question this way. We say it doesn't make sense. And saying, is it possible to learn? You see, suppose, for example, we had this real proprioception, we could see that by thinking about this, we were constantly whipping it up and maintaining it. So we say, what's the point? Let's stop doing it and let me see. I'm really very concerned about my mother and I want to get her the right treatment. Right? That gives me energy. I'm saying, these other people are stupid. They don't understand, they're doing all this. I don't, it's no use trying to get even with them or to get justice or anything like that. You see, the main point is to meet this problem. You see what I mean? But you're not going to meet it unless we understand the principles and the process of this anger.
Are you saying the main point is to meet this problem of the abuse of my mother?
Well, that's the immediate problem, and the long-range problem is that to meet the problem of how human beings are going to face difficult situations
rationally
and effectively and properly, and without disrupting everything, without going into wild chaos.
So the main point is to see, right? To see the dynamic of anger.
Yeah.
And we're going to, and especially to see the falseness in the dynamic of the anger.
Yes, we'll see the falseness, the destructiveness, the valuelessness.
But the point that I think needs to be clarified is to pinpoint what is that falseness, because it's a factual thing that the mother was abused, and it's a factual thing even as I recollect it. It was factual when I saw her, but then an hour later as I recollect
it. It's a perfectly good fact, and we're not disputing it, right?
Right, so where is the falseness?
The falseness is in what happens to me as a result of seeing that fact. You see, suppose I say, I can't bear to see certain things happen, you see, so I get terribly flustered when they happen, but that prevents me from taking any action which would help, right? So therefore, that is not a meaningful kind of behavior.
Could we say that being angry is understandable, and especially at the moment of discovery, but to continue to be angry, how is that going to change the situation?
But our objective is not to change the situation, our objective is to see the whole
Yes, well, we'll see that. I'm suggesting let's begin on something easier and begin to, you see, I'd say that when that happens so fast and you haven't worked on it before, you're going to be overwhelmed by it, right? So I'm saying, but we have leisure now. We don't have to, we have more leisure to look at things now, right? So while we have leisure, let's look.
Yeah. We want to go to kindergarten before we graduate with a PhD.
Well, maybe that's a way of looking at it.
But this is a lady who's been to kindergarten, and she's confronted with a situation where her mother's been abused. Still then, the question becomes, as I think Michael pointed out, of what value is that anger? It's not going to help you to deal with it. It's not, unless, as Searle pointed out, you need that kind of frictional energy to go and beat on doors and get your mother out of there. Basically, no matter how angry you are, isn't going to solve the fact that's already occurred. You have the facts to deal with henceforward, which is how to get her in a situation where she's not going to be subjected to that. The anger, other than that, stirs up your chemistry. Perhaps it gives you a little bit of feeling of release from being self-righteous, but probably it just makes you feel worse.
Yeah, but I question whether or not at that moment of anger you could go through all of this rationalization.
But it's not rationalization. Doing it in a room here or in the tent with Kay or whatever is, for most of us, an intellectual exercise. Someone can get up and talk about anger, and that's beautiful words coming from the tent. But it's meaningless unless it's in the real crisis points in your life where you're confronted with a situation that it has some value, not as an intellectual abstraction which you have further conflict because you've got that abstraction over there telling you you shouldn't be angry and the fact that your anger is there, but really the kind of understanding that is critical at times where there is a crisis.
Would be greatly concerned for you if you didn't get angry when you found your mother's. You know, that would be a real problem because you'd be just like the people. And we're not disparaging that or saying anything. To have a feeling, a strong feeling, is totally natural. But afterwards and subsequent to that, there's something needed more than just anger.
How to deal with the anger is what we're talking
about. Yeah, well, we're saying how do we perceive the anger, you see? This anger is spattering our spectacles with mud. And see, if you want to do something about your mother, about the bad situation that is generally there.
Sure, except for the physiological thing. You don't sleep, you can't eat. I mean, everything is affected by this anger.
Oh, I understand that, you see. But that makes it all the more necessary to understand, to get it, you see. That. And so I'm saying, here we're beginning in a situation where there's less pressure to look at it, you see. I'm saying maybe you could, see, it's good if you would bring, now you're not immediately faced by it, now you can begin to look, right? You see, we need leisure to look at things. It's when you're faced with a whole series of problems, you haven't got it. Right? Now, but then maybe you'll have it later. Now, and then you'll learn something which will enable you to meet it. Now, So what? Begin by looking at this and seeing, I can call up this anchor by just thinking about that situation. Right? Is that true? I just think, what happened to my mother, and you know that these terrible people who did this, and so on, and that I know that I have good reason to be angry. It's justified, and if I keep thinking that way, I'll build up my anger. Right? I'm saying I'm learning something. I'm not trying. We're not trying to solve the problem here. We are trying just to learn how it works. Right?
Well, I can't work up anger anymore about it now, simply because I've already taken action.
Well, maybe not. But then there'll be something else, perhaps, you could do.
Right.
You see, so
I want to point out, though, there's an interesting point, I think, that she's making, which is that the emotion of anger is really the energy to act. And she acted. And now the emotion is not necessary. It's gone.
Yes.
But the anger itself was really more than nothing more, actually, in this case, it seems, than the occasion and the energy to take action.
Yes, well, then also...
an event that requires, really, additional action, because she's going to have to actually come into conflict with other people.
Yes.
Without being violent about it myself.
Without?
Yeah.
Without being violent about it myself.
Yeah. Well, you're trying
to be the essence of anger in the first place, really. Whether be a good, effective use of anger would be, in fact, just to have that additional energy, necessary energy, to overcome the problem.
As long as you can be clear what happens from then on, you see. Now, that's usually the problem that when it's not clear. You see, for example, you have all this anger, you know, which, say, the Iranians have against the Americans. It produces tremendous action. But what good is it? You see, can you have energy with clarity? That's the question.
And
you see, can you have the energy to act with clarity?
Is the question whether anger is efficacious?
Not only that, but what doesn't it also lead you into false? Something false, which will in turn be not effective. But the question of being effective is this, that you are ostensibly angry because you want to do something. You see, you were just talking in terms of using the energy of anger to get something done.
But it sounds like we're evaluating anger according to whether it's efficacious. If I have anger in the immediate instant, and it helps me to act keep that anger, but the anger which comes later, which is not efficacious.
Well, you see, this is a matter of the language, you see. See, let's say there's a first burst of energy, which passion, which arouses you. And we haven't yet labeled it, right? And that energy might enable you to do something, you see. But then you could say, I'm angry. You see, that already has connected up with that whole set of false reactions.
I just want to say that it's something that's the falseness we need to look at, not whether or not the anger is efficacious here or inefficacious there.
Yes, well, that first burst of energy may not be false, right? But very quickly, there's a thought connected with it, which is false, right?
Yeah, I just want to say that that's what we need to get at, not merely say, well, that later anger is not effective.
It's complex, though, isn't it? Because the energy might be creating thoughts that are necessary in order to overcome the problem.
Yeah, yes, but also confusing the issue. So if you could have this energy without those thoughts, you see, suppose we say we have a wild, chaotic energy. But if we remove the thoughts that make it wild, then we have orderly energy.
Don't we have the energy from a state of quietness so that we don't need any anger to have energy? My God, we don't gain energy by having anger. Well, we have energy, period. If we're quiet, if we're clear, we have tremendous energy.
Yes.
To be clear, one has to have tremendous energy, tremendous quietude, from which energy flows. David, doesn't he?
Yes. So
angry doesn't generate energy. I'm expending energy in anger.
Well, let's say, I was trying to look at it a little differently.
Very negative sense.
Yeah, I was trying to look at it a little differently so that we don't begin by condemning anger, you see. That we could say there might be a burst of energy when you see something wrong. In the first burst, you can't say anything about it, right? Because of the whole conditioning, it turns toward what we call anger. It turns toward some kind of urge.
It's counterproductive.
Yes, it's also spatters. It prevents perception and so on.
So it's counterproductive.
Yes. Now, but I think we have to be careful in the form we're talking, not to make any condemnation of this thing, you see, because that will also be counterproductive, right? We have to see anger without anger. Here we have leisure, we can do it. Now, we mustn't get discouraged if we find out that the next occasion arises and the whole thing starts up again, right? Because that's the nature of the problem, you see. But we are learning, right? And I think if you really are serious about this and do this, which I'm suggesting, when you have a chance, you will find that you will become better at, you know, you're able to respond in a more sensible way, right? It may be still that you are also carried away, but you are learning, right? And there might be the ideal case where you didn't respond, but you see, where you were immediately doing the right thing, but we don't necessarily ask for immediate perfection. Let's say that anger, the first response of anger is a survival of our animal ancestry, in my view, right? And there it seemed to make sense for the animal to be able to get angry under certain conditions, right? It produced a response which...
It probably had value, particularly as a display.
A display which kept off the other animals, and it could do various things which somehow made sense, right?
Because you notice that a couple of dogs, they will usually display, and then maybe one of them goes too far. And
yeah.
There was an incident with me when I was in Mexico City. A group of boars were beating up a handicapped child. Let's say there were about 10 boys against this handicapped child. They had their coats off and they were beating him. And I was very, very angry. I just stepped in there and said, stop it, and start lecturing them. The handicapped boy ran away, and everything was settled. The reaction of the anger came later when I trembled, because I realized, you know, I could have been hurt. But I didn't think about it, and I don't think mothers think about it when they're protecting their children or when you see child abuse or when you see any human abuse. You just, action takes place without thinking. Perhaps there's anger with it, but the action is immediate without thought.
Or else there may be thought, which is correct thought, you see. Mm-hmm. You see, I'm trying to say there's a kind of thought which is causing the trouble, you get entangled with this kind of thought that maintains anger, you know, like saying that, this is terrible, it's outrageous, I have good reason to be angry, and so on, you see. That, on the other hand, you may have to think, what is the right action? Some thought may be required to carry out the right action.
I don't remember thinking at that point.
It may not, but you see, if for a more sustained kind of action, you would have to think what to do, right? Let's say you have a burst of energy and you take an action, and this may include in a sustained action some thinking, but there's the kind of thinking we're talking about, thought we're talking about, which is destructive, you see, and which the human race is constantly getting into, you see. Right, well, then we'll, if you'll go into this and think about it in the right way, perhaps you can raise the questions again tomorrow after considering it over the night.